right, excellent. Well, I want to thank everyone for joining us today. My name is Seth Zirkle. I'm an attorney here in Evansville, Indiana. I actually think that we may have some of our past participants as far away from the Lone Star State, and that's not the professor. We actually, professor, have had a couple of folks join us. One of the unintended benefits, happy benefits of having meetings by Zoom is that we have been, as a very fairly small lawyers chapter, to bring participants in from areas that otherwise they would not be able to join us if we had in-person presentations. But at any rate, again, my name is Seth Zirkle. I want to thank you all for joining us today for our presentation by Professor Josh Blackman and Abortion Dobbs and the Future of the Conservative Legal Movement. I am just thrilled and tickled to death to be able to introduce Professor Blackman. He is a national thought leader on constitutional law and the United States Supreme Court, routine contributor to the Volokh Conspiracy, which if you do not read it or follow it, you should be doing so. His work is quoted during two presidential impeachment trials, and he has testified before Congress and advises federal and state lawmakers and regularly appears on TV. He has published commentaries in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and other leading national publications. Since 2012, Professor Blackman has served as a professor at the South Texas College of Law, Houston. He's also an adjunct scholar at Cato, and he's authored three books. His latest, An Introduction to Constitutional Law, was top five bestseller on Amazon. And as a history buff, I immensely enjoy his postings regarding this day in Supreme Court history on the
Glad someone likes him.
Oh, they are awesome. He was Professor Blackman was selected by Forbes magazine for their 30 under 30 in law and policy. He is the president of Harlan Institute, founded Fantasy SCOTUS, which if you do not have the app downloaded, the website on your mobile device, you are missing out. Without further ado, it is my distinct honor to welcome Professor Blackman. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Seth. It's a pleasure to visit with you. I clerked in Louisville, Kentucky, back in 2011-12, which is close enough to where you are, but it's in your backyard. Hopefully at some point when I'm back in town, I can visit with you all again, perhaps in person. Seth asked me to come talk to you about a topic that I think is very relevant and timely for the Federal Society and its members. That is Dobbs, abortion, and the future of the conservative legal movement. We are standing at something of a inflection point. For much of the 20th century, the Supreme Court was dominated by progressives. The first few decades were a little bit to the right, and the rest of it was slowly and then fast going towards the left. But now, really, for the first time in any of our lifetimes, there are six conservative members on the Supreme Court. And what are they going to do with those votes? Perhaps the most significant and pressing area where change may occur is actually abortion. As we speak, the justices are deliberating in a case called Dobbs versus Mississippi. This case considers the validity of Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban. Under current settled law, Planned Parenthood versus Casey and Roe v. Wade, the Mississippi law is unconstitutional. The purpose of Dobbs is a direct challenge to Roe, and the parties call on the court to invalidate that precedent. But here, I am not just talking about abortion and Dobbs. I want to take a step back and offer an assessment of the Roberts Court, where it was last term, where is it this term, and what might we expect at the end of June of this present term. Now, I caution you, my predictions are almost always wrong. As they say, you get what you pay for. You are getting what you're paying for, which is not much. So let's start, take a step back and look at last term. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg suddenly passed away in September of 2020. A few weeks before the presidential election, President Trump nominated a native of your state, a Hoosier, Amy Coney Barrett, to the Supreme Court. She was confirmed a couple days before the election. And shortly after she got into the court, she cast an important vote in a case called New York Roman Catholic Diocese. I'm sorry, the Brooklyn Catholic Diocese versus Cuomo. This was a challenge to one of the COVID lockdown measures from New York that restricted houses of worship to a very small number of people, even if you have these ginormous cathedrals that fit thousands of people. Earlier that summer, the court's four liberals plus Chief Justice Roberts said that they would not intervene in that to allow these restrictions to go into effect. When in one of Barrett's first votes, she voted the other way and put on hold a New York policy that restricted houses of worship. This was a momentous change in the court and signaled that the old majority may not be around forever. But still, there were several cases last term where the court's three most conservative members, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch, were worried. They were worried that Justice Barrett, as well as the other new member, Justice Kavanaugh, were perhaps going astray. In fact, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch wrote that Barrett and Kavanaugh lacked backbone. Backbone, if you can imagine. There was an excessive force case. And the conservative trio wrote that the two newest justices were unwilling to bear the criticism that denying the prisoner's appeal would inevitably elicit. They were afraid, they said. And in a religious liberty case, the Thomas III charged that Kavanaugh and Barrett lacked the, quote, fortitude to overrule a controversial precedent. The conservatives implied a similar fissure in several other cases. Now, it's fairly common for justices to criticize their colleagues' legal judgment, but it is rare for the justices to claim that their colleagues are motivated by cowardice. You see, the 6-3 conservative majority is not monolithic. In my view, we have something of a 3-3-3 court. There are three progressives, three conservatives, and three members in the middle. We don't know whether Kavanaugh and Barrett will consistently vote with the conservatives, or if they'll go with Chief Justice Roberts' more moderate, cautious jurisprudence. So let's start with the perhaps most unsatisfying case from last term, which was Fulton v. City of Philadelphia. Catholic Social Services refused to certify unmarried couples and same-sex couples as prospective foster families for purposes of adoption. In response, Philadelphia refused to contract with Catholic Social Services. The Court of Appeals upheld this decision based on Employment Division versus Smith. This precedent, authored by the late Justice Scalia, held that the government can generally burden religion so long as the law is applied neutrally. And the lower courts held that Philadelphia did not target Catholic Social Services. Now, there's a mountain of scholarship that Justice Scalia was wrong. And Catholic Social Services called on the court to overrule Smith. Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch would have overruled Smith. But Barrett and Kavanaugh would not overrule Smith. They doubted that Smith was correct, and they expressed an openness to reversing in the future, but did not think this case presented the right opportunity. You have to believe that on their minds was Dobbs and Roe, right? If they overruled the Smith case, that would sort of box them in overruling the abortion precedents. And I think that had to weigh in on their minds. They weren't quite ready to overrule this case from decades earlier. Justice Gorsuch was not pleased with Barrett and Kavanaugh. He wrote a sharp concurrence joined by Thomas and Alito. Gorsuch had the majority dodge the question today. Excuse me. And Gorsuch gave a not-so-subtle warning to the other two Trump appointees. He wrote, "These cases will keep coming to the court until the court musters the fortitude to supply the answer." Gorsuch called out Barrett and Kavanaugh for lacking fortitude. This personal attack no doubt reflects simmering tensions within the court. And those tensions have now spilled into public view. The 333 fracture emerged in other religious liberty cases last term. In South Bay United Pentecostal Church versus Newsom, the six justices ruled, a conservative ruled, that California cannot prohibit indoor worship. But the majority split about whether the state could prohibit singing. Thomas and Gorsuch would have allowed singing. Alito would have given the state 30 days to prove that California's ban would actually curb the spread of COVID. But Barrett wrote a concurrence, which Kavanaugh joined, finding that the churches did not meet the burden and that singing ban could remain. Barrett used her first separate writing, the court, to rule against people of faith. And I can go on. There were a number of cases last year where it seemed that Barrett and Kavanaugh simply were not willing to go quite as far as Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch. And that history brings us to Dobbs. Mississippi enacted a law that was a direct challenge to Roe. They knew that. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals said that the Mississippi law is invalid under precedent. It was. Even Judge Jim Ho, who is not a squish by any definition of the human language, said that under a Roe and Casey, I must uphold the statute. And then Ho said those precedents were wrong. Right. But this is a clear case where under the law, under the governing precedent, the Mississippi law is invalid. The court was not in a hurry to even hear Dobbs. The case was relisted, or we say is rescheduled over and over again, almost a dozen times. They were sitting on it, waiting. They didn't want to decide the case last year. But finally, in May of 2020, the court granted certiorari in Dobbs. And they did something kind of funny. They rewrote the question presented, right? The court always considers a question. Mississippi's question was, can we overrule Roe and Casey? Let's go. And the court rewrote the question saying, well, are all pre-viability abortions invalid under the Constitution or something to that effect? But it became clear that in this case would have the potential to overrule Roe and Casey. So what does Dobbs mean for the conservative legal movement, right? It has a lot of meaning for people of faith, for the pro-life community, I think for the Republican Party. Right, all these various constituencies have a very strong interest in abortion and Roe v. Wade. People believe in the sanctity of life, that abortion is murder, that it's sinful, that we should not have it. And we have millions of people who can articulate these views candidly. But I approach it from a different perspective. What does this case mean for the conservative legal movement? Now, I can't see you all, unfortunately, but and I don't know your age groups, but for many law students who are coming of age now in the 2000s and the 2010s, they don't really understand the before times. I'm young enough. I don't remember the before times either. But in the 70s and the 80s, the idea of a conservative legal movement didn't really exist, right? Roe v. Wade was decided by a 7-2 vote, and many of the Republican justices joined that opinion. The idea of textualism and originalism was considered fringe. The notion that you would have judges consult historical matters was often considered kind of like, who cares what the framers thought? The living constitution was in the vanguard. But that movement started to shift in the 70s and to the 80s. Roe v. Wade was not the cause of that shift, but I think it contributed to that shift. Roe was viewed as a sort of this white whale, like this embodiment of what judges should not do, of recognizing constitutional rights and the penumbras and the emanations from the 14th Amendment. Roe was just this dreadful precedent that needed to go. And President Reagan and other conservatives ran on a platform appointing judges who'd overrule Roe v. Wade. The Reagan and then the Bush administration filed briefs in court saying we need to overrule Roe v. Wade. President Reagan had a couple Supreme Court nominations. He appointed Sandra Day O'Connor. That one went through smoothly. He appointed Antonin Scalia. That one smoothly. He had 98-0 vote. And then we got to the third pick. The first nominee was a man named Robert Bork. That did not go well. Senator Biden presided over that hearing, and it did not go well at all for Bork. He was considered this radical conservative, and he was voted down in the Senate. President Reagan briefly nominated or tried to nominate Doug Ginsburg, but that blew up very quickly in smoke. And then it went on to the third nominee, Anthony Kennedy. All right. Fast forward a couple years, William Brennan retires under Republican presidency, the liberal lion. And President George H.W. Bush picks who? David Souter to replace William Brennan. David who? Exactly. And then when Thurgood Marshall steps down, President Bush picks Clarence Thomas to fill the seat. So now you basically had 8 Republican-appointed justices in the court. 8. 8, not 5, not 6, 8. And the only Democratic appointee, Byron White, had dissented in Roe v. Wade. So that brings us to Planned Parenthood versus Casey. The court asks to overrule Roe. The court does not. In a joint opinion by O'Connor, the Reagan nominee, Kennedy, the Reagan nominee, Souter, the Bush nominee, they reaffirm Roe. And they do some other funny business. They say they create a new test. I'm not so concerned about that here. But despite everything that happened the last 2 decades, with the conservative movement building up and the federal side giving steam, we still have Republican-appointed justices voting in favor of Roe to sustain it on the grounds of stare decisis, standing by precedent. So as they fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, whatever it is, as George Bush would say. They tried again. For the next 2 decades, conservatives rallied around the cause of textualism and originalism. The idea that judges should not make up substantive due process rights, that Roe was wrong. And we have 2 more Supreme Court nominations. Chief Justice Roberts replaces Rehnquist. And now Justice Alito replaces Connor. Still not enough votes to overrule Roe. Fast forward even more years. We're talking decades, and we get to the Trump presidency. Scalia is replaced by Gorsuch. Right? Had that vote gone the other way, had we had a Justice Merrick Garland, Roe would have been here for 100 years. But then there comes a big one. Kennedy replaced by Kavanaugh. Now the deciding vote from Casey's gone, replaced by Brett Kavanaugh. And for good measure, Justice Ginsburg's replaced by Amy Coney Barrett. So now we have 6 conservative justices who have been expressly asked to overrule Roe v. Wade. I'm not going to make a prediction of what's going to happen here. My predictions are almost always wrong. But instead, I want to discuss what will happen to sort of our movement with the 2 possibilities, right? Let's do the sort of the worst case scenario first, right? Let's say you have an opinion by 5, maybe even 6 justices saying, we think Roe was wrongly decided, but in light of stare decisis, standing by precedent, we're gonna stand by Roe and Casey. We're not going to disturb it. Mississippi, your law is invalid. Go home. I think that ruling would cause shockwaves in ways that are not easy to anticipate. The conservative movement has been targeting Roe for many years and trying to put judges in the court who would reflect that belief. And if all these efforts over the course of 40 years came up with naught, people might start questioning, why are we wasting our time with this movement? Right? Why are we wasting our time with originalists and textualists? Why don't we just put on the equivalent of conservative judges, right? The same way that President Biden wants a progressive justice with the heart. Why don't we put on a conservative justice with the brain, right? A smart conservative who can just make conservative rulings. I don't know which way that cuts. Do people start looking for change within FedSoc, or do they look for groups outside the federal society? Senator Hawley in Missouri has said the conservative movement died after the Bostock case involving Title VII. Others have suggested maybe there should be different groups. James Wilson with Hadley Arkus is very active here. Adrian Vermeule is pushing his thesis on common good constitutionalism. There's a new book coming out by that title. But I think what's going to be hard to justify, though, is to tell politicians that they should try to be looking for these types of judges for the Supreme Court, right? Why would a president sort of follow the advice of smart lawyers who gave us judges who simply said, ah, never mind, Roe's good enough? And I don't think it matters if the court rules conserve in other ways, like in guns or voting rights. Abortion, I think, is a unique issue. It's so salient to the conservative mission for 40 or 50 years that I think it basically towers up all these other things, right? I mean, really, do people really care if California allows residents to have guns or New York? Just don't live there, right? I think the abortion issue does loom so largely in these matters, right? So I worry that our movement can have a fracture, even a schism. And I don't know quite what that looks like. I think that would be unfortunate. I very much appreciate how our movement sort of has this sort of synergy of legal thought, libertarianism, conservatism, politics. There's a good blend. But that blend, I think, becomes harder to sustain if the court just whiffs, especially if Barrett and Kavanaugh join Roberts to reaffirm Roe. We're basically back in 1991 with Casey, right? So it's another joint opinion, you know, same thing. And I think that sort of changes a person, right? A judge who does that in their early career, I think will forever be marked by it, because they'll always be judged by that standard. It's like, well, you voted for the right, you voted for the left in Casey, I'm sorry, in Dobbs, why don't you do it again, right? You sort of, pardon the phrase, but you sell your soul. Once you do that, once you make that decision, you're stuck with it. And it's hard to escape it. I think Chief Justice Roberts did that with the Obamacare decision, which I've written two books about. Once you make that change, you sort of cave. You can't undo that. And it really affects who you are as a judge for forever. So I think that the Dobbs case is really a litmus test for where the Roberts Court goes for the decades ahead. Now, let me do the other side. Let's say the court doesn't cave and squish. Let's say the court says, you know what? We're going to go along with overruling Roe. The case was wrong when it was decided. It's wrong today. Roe failed to actually resolve disputes about abortion. It simply created more controversies, right? None of the factors for stare decisis counsel keeping this case, or we don't agree with Casey, right? Casey set the wrong standard for stare decisis. Who cares, right? If there's an egregiously wrong constitutional decision, get rid of it. Why are we letting the dead hand of William Brennan and Harry Blackmun and these other people govern us forever? Move on with it. It had a 50-year run. It failed. Done. If that happens, where do we go? Well, I think the movement then has a slightly different position. What would be the rallying cry? There's no issue like guns that unites conservatives. I'm sorry, abortion. Some like guns or some economic issues that there's some people care for affirmative action, but there's no single rallying cry. So I think you have to start thinking about where conservatives are focusing their energies. Now, there's also the possibility of a backlash, right? If states start banning abortion outright, that can create political chaos. And I don't know where that shakes out. And frankly, I don't really care, right? That's how politics works. If people enact bad laws, they can change those laws later. But the fight over abortion would finish even at that point. Because I think Texas and other states start getting creative and say, well, we can ban abortion in our states. What if we ban our citizens from leaving the state to get abortions? And that creates some actually really tricky dormant commerce clause issues and right to travel questions about whether you can ban abortions in other states, extraterritoriality, involving a Texas person. So the debates about abortion don't simply vanish overnight. But I'm almost at 30 minutes. I want to sort of leave you with this thought. Don't take the judge in the Supreme Court shouldn't take for granted that the movement that supports him will exist forever. Right. When they walk into these rooms and get these thundering standing ovations, you know, that's not automatic. There is a movement and it has certain beliefs. And if the judges simply abjure those because of pressure otherwise, then the judge will sort of be on their own. So we're sitting here, you know, in the middle of February. June is 4 months away. I don't know what's going to happen in the Dobbs case. I'm somewhat nervous. Looking out for leaks, I haven't seen any evidence of leaks yet. If there's leaks, that means something changed or something is going to change. And I'm nervous about that as well. But we should just be very cautious the next 4 months and don't count your chickens before they hatch. All right. That's all I have for my prepared remarks. I have a small crowd here, so if we have a nice discussion, we can talk about this a bit more. But thank you so much for your attention, and I welcome your questions.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. Very engaging and insightful. Given our small crowd, I would like to go ahead and open it up for questions. Please bear in mind that questions do end with a question mark. So the format would be, please unmute your mic, state the question, and then please go ahead and mute the mic back so that we do not have any background noise. So we'll go ahead and open that up for any questions that folks may have. Thank you.
All right. I see Jay. Is that a question from Jay? Go ahead. Do I give you permission to speak, or Seth, can you give him permission to speak? I think you have to give him permission to speak. I'm not a host. Seth, you there?
I apologize. Yeah, I should. Jay, you should have available.
Can you make me a host, please? So in Zoom, if you click my name under panels, does it make host?
Let's see here. I am having a hard time finding that. I apologize.
Okay. Okay.
Did that work? I just tried giving.
All right, you... I got. Thank you, Sean. All right, Jay, you should be able to talk now.
All right, thank you, Professor Blackman. I think it's working out. So I had a question kind of in regards to your comments about the conservative libertarian fusionist movement, whatever it is that we want to call it as a whole. I think it's kind of undeniable that the core contribution, at least successfully, of that movement is kind of this commitment to originalism or textualism as a mode of legal analysis. And kind of connecting that with some of your comments, do you find any intrinsic value in that mode of analysis, or are you kind of judging it just based off of the outcomes? And if it's not producing the outcomes that were kind of originally intended, that it doesn't really have any value left as a mode of legal analysis?
Yeah, really good question, Jay. Thank you. I'm an originalist. I'm happy to say it. I have a card on my wall that says card carrying originalist. My students made it for me. I like originalism without regard to the outcome it yields. And I think very often originalism yields outcomes that I don't particularly like. A lawyer can say that. A politician can't, right? If you're a politician, you can't run on a platform of, I'm going to favor a principle no matter what outcome it reaches. Politicians are invariably results-driven people, right? So the synergy between legal principle, originalism, and politics, pragmatism, links up in many regards because I think originalism does yield many conservative results. It does. Generally, the idea is you don't do new stuff, you do old stuff, we conserve, that's conservatism. But if originalism starts being understood to yield non-conservative results on a consistent basis, it becomes harder for politicians to go up to a straight face and say, I want originalist judges, right? And this, I'm speaking, of course, to the Bostock case, right? This was about whether Title VII prohibits LGBT discrimination. Now, Justice Gorsuch wrote an opinion that he insists is textualist and originalist. I vigorously disagree. But regardless of whether you disagree, if this is the sort of things textualists and originalists do, they write opinions like Bostock, or they reaffirm Roe v. Wade and Dobbs, non-lawyers start saying, well, what the hell is this original stuff good for? I don't want it. Right, there's always this uneasy relationship where lawyers say, well, we need this legal principle, and you'll like some of the stuff, it's good. And they're like, okay, we don't really care about this principle stuff, we like the outcomes. But if there's a disjunction between the outcomes and the theory consistently, you're not going to have popular political support for originalism. And when that support dies, the people writing Supreme Court shortlists are not going to be originalists anymore, right? It'll be someone else. They won't be thinking about text and history. They'll be thinking about common good constitutionalism, like Adrian Vermeule. And then in the long run, I think we suffer for it because I think those theories are not very useful for courts, right? Then we're simply just saying, well, you have your Sotomayor, we'll have our Vermeule, right? You know, you have judged with your principle about, you know, liberal principles, we'll have conservative principles. I don't put a priest on the Supreme Court. I don't know. I put Father Scalia instead of Justice Scalia in the Supreme Court. Although Justice Scalia's son was a priest. I think that's a mistake. I think we lose in the long run. So I hope that fusionism, to use your phrase, Jay, survives for as long as possible. But there'll be a serious sort of introspection after the Dobbs case about where we actually stand in that regard. All right, let's see what other questions we have. Dan, let's give you permission to talk. Dan, I'm sorry, I said Dan.
If Roe is turned down, I mean, if Roe dies, then we're really getting rid of stare decisis. And that, it seems to me, is very serious, because now you're in the zone. You're part of the living constitution camp, it seems to me, at that point. And everything's up for grabs. And originalism is completely and utterly irrelevant, as practically everything is, if nothing is stable. If you can change anything you want to, then what does principle matter of any kind?
Well, thank you for the question. And let me try to answer it directly. Justice Thomas, I would say, is the court's most committed originalist. I think everyone probably agrees with me on that one. Thomas has explained at some length that there's a tension between stare decisis precedent and originalism. There's a tension. I think we all can concede that. Right? We have all these decisions from the Warren Court and the Berger Court where they just made stuff up, right? Had no basis in original meaning. But societies have come to rely on it. So Miranda, for example, right? These warnings were just made up of whole cloth. They're made up. But the court declined to overrule Miranda in a case called Dickerson in 2000. Scalia and Thomas were in dissent. What's the relationship between stare decisis and originalist? Can you be an originalist without favoring stare decisis? Well, that's Thomas, right? Can you be an originalist with a strong letter for stare decisis? That might be Barrett or Kavanaugh, right? So I don't think they're inconsistent. I don't think overruling Roe would get rid of stare decisis altogether, but I think it would definitely make it a weaker force. And you need to have very strong, compelling evidence of original meaning to get rid of those cases. The court's overruled a number of precedents in recent years. So in the Janus case a couple of years ago, this involves whether the government can take fees from union employees for public workers. The court ruled a case called Abood from the late 70s, a unanimous decision. I think the rationale to overrule Abood was pretty weak, wasn't great, right? Dobbs, though, there's not much constitutional ruling. If you actually read the Roe case, there's a lot of thin air, right? There's just not much law there. They kind of just made it up. Then again, people rely on this in 50-something states. 50 states plus all the various territories, right? This is a law nationwide. So I don't know if overruling Dobbs destroys stare decisis, but it makes it much weaker. And if you do have a super conservative majority for years to come, there are probably other precedents around the chopping block. For example, next term, you have affirmative action, right? From the Harvard case and from UNC. Does the court overrule Bakke? Does the court overrule Grutter versus Bollinger from Michigan? Right? There are a lot of other cases that might fall, or so the conservatives will say, we're writing the law, we're putting ourselves back into the direction of original meaning. And I don't know, is there a stopping point? Like, what else is on the deck? But your question, Dan, I think is well stated. A lot will change after this term. We're sort of really at an inflection point. But thank you. I see Natalie has a question in the chat. Do you think that Justice Gorsuch can still be considered a strong conservative after Bostock? Or do you think that was an aberration? Look, Gorsuch has a virtue that's also a vice. He is really, really sure of himself, right? Like, do you ever second guess yourself? I do it all the time. Like, am I really right about this? I don't get the sense Gorsuch does that. I think when he makes up his mind, he makes up his mind and he sticks with it till the ends of earth, right? Gorsuch convinced himself that the textualist answer is that Title VII prohibits discrimination because of sex. And because of sex means sexual orientation, gender identity, he absolutely convinced himself. I don't doubt his conservative bona fides. We've had cases this term of religious liberty where he's far to the right, I mean, almost the right of Thomas. So maybe it's an aberration, but I will tell you every now and then, if Gorsuch gets in his craw that there's something that the others are wrong about, that Thomas is wrong about, he will not hesitate to go to the ends of earth to defend it. So again, it's there are pros and cons to that position. But I think he's still very conservative, but just, he aberrates, if that's even a word, every now and then. Thank you for the question, Natalie. What other questions we have? Small group. There's time for everyone.
Well, Professor, I'll go ahead and take co-panelists' presenters' prerogative here and ask you. You've had a couple of recent postings on the blog on conspiracy regarding, it's not it's on the opposite end of the spectrum, but, you know, Biden's commitment to appoint a woman of color to the Supreme Court. And you, I think, was posting yesterday regarding the various machinations of these camps behind shortlist nominees. Want to see if you might just offer up some of your thoughts as to where things stand and the merits of President Biden committing himself to appointing a woman of color to the court.
I just have one word: popcorn.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying this fight because we've gone through three nominations on our side in 4 years, basically, right? In the 4 years of the Trump presidency, we had three Supreme Court nominations. That's insane. Justice Breyer was a junior justice for like 11 years, and we had three noms in 4 years. So I'm actually enjoying fighting the other side. At the outset, Biden limited himself, and he did this before he got elected. He's going to pick a female black woman. He made this point on the campaign trail. Right. So that really narrows down the universe of people you can pick. And even if you are generous with your list, just maybe 10, 15, maybe you could pick. And that's sort of been narrowed down to three. So you have Judge Jackson in the D.C. Circuit. You have Judge Childs in the federal court in South Carolina. She's been, and then you have Justice Kruger on the California Supreme Court. I don't know that it really matters who he picks from my perspective. The vote will probably be something I don't agree with much. What I do care about is which one will have, perhaps the best relation with the other justice and which one of the least contentious hearing. That's something I do care about. But what's going on now is these nominees, or at least potential nominees, and their surrogates are engaging in this all-out battle to try and knock out the other qualified candidate. So right now, a lot of the attention is focusing on Judge Childs, the judge from South Carolina. This is just popcorn, right? I couldn't believe this. NPR, Nina Totenberg, who, as I recall, released the Anita Hill story and well, she got scooped on the Kavanaugh stuff, but she tried to have this silly story at the last minute that Neil Gorsuch had bad teaching evaluations. This was just nuts. The story just vanished quickly. But she's tried to kill nominees before that she's done that. And Nina had a story about Judge Child's father. And Judge Child's father was a police officer. And I had read before that her father was killed in the line of action, right? In the line of duty. And, you know, if you're a person and your father is killed in the line of duty, I think you have a certain perspective on criminal law, right? You respect law enforcement. That'd be my perspective. And then Nina has a story where she says, wait a minute. Her father wasn't killed in the line of duty. He killed himself. He committed suicide. My goodness, what do we, who the hell released this? Why is that in the news? Are we really litigating whether this woman has perhaps not properly characterized her father's death? A suicide in law enforcement is a dreadful matter. I can't imagine the pressures a cop in Detroit was going through in the 70s. Can you imagine? What goes through your head? So, but that showed me that the knives were out for Judge Childs, right? There was a story in the American, was it, it's not the Spectator, one of the liberal rags, that said apparently Judge Childs sentenced a person for 8 ounces of marijuana for like 10 years in prison. Who's doing opposition research on poor Judge Childs down in South Carolina, the trial bench? I mean, that's not like a federal, court with electronic records. You got to go and dig. And they actually found the guy who she sentenced for all those years for marijuana. David Ladhorns, an excellent Substack, put together this sort of this collective letter supporting Justice Kruger. And there are all these things saying that Judge Childs is too conservative. He's too conservative. So look, there are active attempts trying to disqualify this woman from the Supreme Court. Just stunning how brazen it's been. I'm sure there's going to be retaliation from the Childs people because they're not going to take the sitting down, right? You don't bring a knife to a gunfight. And I think Jim Clyburn has the goods on Kruger and Jackson. I'm just waiting for it to come out. No one's perfect. So again, my one word is popcorn. This is sort of a circular stabbing squad. I'm just going to enjoy them stabbing each other. I wish it didn't happen, but this process is going to just play out its course. Biden has about 10 more days till a self-imposed deadline, the end of February. We'll see who he nominates. And then that person will probably get confirmed unless something crazy happens. And, has anyone checked Judge Child's yearbook? Do you know where she was in Beach Week? I mean, do we have any idea if she likes beer? I mean, who knows, right? Give Michael Avenatti a call. Maybe he has some time on his hands. He's nothing else to do. He's in prison. But I think that this process is going to get ugly very quickly. What other questions you have? Natalie, go ahead. I'll give you permission to talk. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks. I was having trouble unmuting before, but I appreciate your time. And I know you're kind of alluding to it before at the beginning of your presentation about it would strike a big blow to the conservative legal movement if Roe was upheld. But do you have any thoughts of why, and I think this has baffled an ongoing debate with the whole conservative legal movement, why justices nominated who seemingly are conservative and are conservative when they get there? We never doubt the liberal justices are completely, almost crazily liberal in their rulings. So why can't they be consistently conservative when they get on the court?
Yeah, it's a million-dollar question. Thank you so much for that question, Natalie. Right, so the question is this. The issue is like this. The legal profession is progressive. It leans left. And all the pressure is on the legal profession to become progressive. And it requires a sense of strength and fortitude to resist that. It's possible that some of the nominees simply lack that fortitude and they shift to the left. It's also possible they point to people who are never conservative to begin with. Like, I don't think David Souter was conservative. I think he was a terrible nominee. They even got like John Roberts, who is a conservative, but he has this sort of this streak of judicial restraint that can be exploited by the left to sort of, okay, they, when we need him, we can get his vote for the left. Otherwise, we don't need him anymore, right? And then that brings us to Kavanaugh and Barrett, right? These are people who are basically engineered in a federal society petri dish, right? They were basically grown up in our camps. And what went wrong, or did anything go wrong, that they were unable to sort of resist the pressures of the job? Again, I'm reserving judgment on Barrett. I haven't made my mind on her. I'll give it another year or two, see what happens in Dobbs. I think Kavanaugh just cares deeply about how he's viewed and how the court's viewed. And there's really no way around that. That is who he is. He's in politics for his entire life. He worked in the Bush White House. He gets politics. He's very sharp in that regard. But I think it sort of puts manacles on him. It sort of holds him back. And it doesn't let him sort of flourish. And he's a brilliant guy. I mean, his opinion in, was it Tandon versus Newsom, when the COVID case for the summer, was excellent. It was the best thing I've read in years. And I just feel otherwise, he's just kind of like, you know, like it's like pumping the brakes. He doesn't want to go too far, too fast. Again, look, Dana, we'll see Natalie, we'll see what happens in Dobbs. A lot matters what happens in this case. I think this will define the court for a generation, in the same way that Casey defined that court, the rankless court for a generation.
Thank you.
Thank you, though, for the question. What else we got? Dan and Natalie, so their hands up. Anyone else want to ask a question? Seth, anything else, or we wrapped?
I think that unless any of the other participants has a question, I think we will call it a day. I want to thank you, Professor, for sharing these remarks with us. Very insightful. I want to thank our participants. The Lawyers Chapter here in Evansville is a fairly new one. We just started up in 2018, and you know, survived remote participation during COVID. And you know, one of the happy, like I said, results of that is being able to have presentations from folks like Professor Blackman halfway across the country, which is awesome. Thank you all for joining us. Please be on the lookout for our next presentation, which will be coming up in April. It will be the Associate Solicitor General from Puerto Rico giving a discussion on the Territories Clause in the Constitution, which I'm sure not too many of us remember from constitutional law. So be on the lookout for that email. Again, Professor, thank you so much. And with that, we are adjourned.
Everyone, thank you.